interest in, I'm sure. Most everyone knows Dr. Kevin Powell. He will talk about his life work as part of the whole understanding of the way that faith and science speak to each other, so I'm going to let him do that. But he is a pediatrician, specialized in hospitalized children, a chemist, an engineer, and longtime participant in groups that talk about the relationship between faith and science. And since he's going to do his big intro, I just want to tell you a really short story about, and this is only because it was important to me, it's not fact. I struggle a lot with our faith depending on kind of preposterous ideas, like a human man wouldn't have had a human father, and that we sort of assent to that, and all the big questions about, do you have to factually believe what we say we believe every Sunday? And the fact that I can't, and then say, well, then what's left for me is a struggle. And I know that Kevin has studied the faith. When I said to him, how do you do this as a scientist? You know, work in all the supernatural magic stuff and still believe. How do you do that? And he one said, and this is what was just, he said, faith and science ask different questions. And that was just somehow important to me. And so they can live in some relationship. And the other thing is, I remember you describing looking through the Hubble telescope at the multiverse, at the universe, and just being filled with awe. And it just sort of, I go, okay, the God stuff is still there, and it's powerful, and it may not come in the kind of non-scientific things that we are supposed to believe if we're Christians. But it sort of got me by for another 2 years. So I don't know what you're going to talk about today, but I hope I was even close.
Good morning. Thank you very much for coming. I have done a lot in the faith and science area, so let me give you a little bit of my background, because I believe that people need to know who is speaking in order to really understand what they're saying and what their biases are and what they bring. I am an engineer primarily. That is the way I have thought about myself, even though I've worked as a pediatrician for the past 20 years. I was trained as an engineer. My first professional job was an engineer. I worked for Procter & Gamble in a math and computing division. I was the computer person who could do things that nobody else could make a computer do, because I could write in the assembler language of the computer itself. From there, I went on to MIT and got both a master's degree in chemical engineering and a PhD in medical engineering. As I did that, I became more interested in the overall impact of medicine and the ethics of what we were doing than I was on any particular technology. And I thought if I was going to comment on that and medical ethics through the years, I actually had to finish the MD. So I ended up doing that and the residency and got into pediatrics. And I used to see well babies and give shots in the office, but now my practice is entirely in the hospitals. And I am part of the American Academy of Pediatrics section of hospital medicine's exec board, working on making that a subspecialty, which will occur. First tests for it are in 2019. So that's that thread of it. I've also been a clinical ethicist. I have run ethics committees. I have done consults when there are issues. And let's face it, most of the time in medicine, when there are issues, it's a miscommunication. I say that 90% of consults are 100% communication problems, and the other 10% of them are mostly communication problems. I don't actually use a whole lot of my philosophy background when I end up doing clinical ethics. I've also somewhere along that line got involved in the faith and science issues. There is a exec board of a Lutheran Alliance on Faith, Science, and Technology that provides some consulting services basically to the ELCA, and I was on that for 18 years and chaired it for three. And that's part of where this comes, the talk today comes from, but most of today's talk actually comes from the fact that as I've done my medicine recently, since I have all that research background but am primarily a clinician, I moderate the listserv for the pediatric hospitalists across the nation. And so it was about 4,000 to 5,000 of us, and over 3,000 of them are on that listserv. And with that, we exchange information. My point has been, if you just share information, you get rid of the, it wasn't done that way here type of thing. It wasn't invented here type of thing. And it has made some progress in medical science, as well as reveal how much of what we are publishing is just plain wrong. I tell medical students and medical residents that half of what I was taught in medical school has since been proven obsolete or absolutely wrong. And I have no reason to believe I'm a better teacher than my teachers were. So half of what I'm teaching is probably wrong, and good luck figuring out which half. You are gonna worry by the time you get done today about going to a doctor. But part of what I'm after these days is saying, why is it that so much of what we are publishing is incorrect, and even the parts that we do publish that is correct, our medical students can't figure out which part of it is right and which part of it is not. What I have found then is that the study of what is called justified belief or truth has a term called epistemology with a very, very long history in philosophy and religion. Medicine thinks it's invented it in the last 25 years and is only off by about a factor of 100. And that's where this sort of comes from, is that we've had it, there are definite changes recently, and I want to kind of cover them in this era of post-truth. For instance, this came up this week. It is a totally false story that the Pope converted Stephen Hawking on his deathbed recently, and yet it had been shared well over 10,000 times by the time the Washington Post got a hold of it and wrote a little story on it. Yes, Stephen Hawking and the Pope have met. In fact, he had met with three different popes over his career as part of various projects between the Vatican and science. But we have these things of fake news. And then I'm going to bring up a couple current events. And these are sort of the things I'm not going to talk much about today, because I'm trying to say this is outside of what I really want to focus on, but I have to kind of get you a background on it. Mark Zuckerberg, who is the CEO of Facebook, acknowledged making a mistake in trusting app developers to use Facebook data properly. I don't know about you, but I'm used to when people legally certify that they're going to do something, that they do it. But I think this was clearly a mistake in retrospect. This is a problem of putting a 30-year-old in charge of some sort of major event. He didn't seem to understand, yes, there are actually evil people out there in the world. We need to make sure it doesn't happen again. Worse, these are almost the exact same words that he had from a couple weeks earlier and last year, talking about the Russian influence on the election and how Facebook had really allowed Russian bots to put a whole lot of false fake news into the world. I view it as a pollution of the book of knowledge that we have as humans. It's been created that at one time, you may recall from those of you who are old enough, that we had three TV news stations, and in the evening news there were three anchors, all white males, but they would tell you what the truth was, and they competed with each other to find what was most relevant, what was most important to you, what could they fit in to 30 minutes. And they were also very worried about getting it right. That has been replaced by internet service providers who claim, well, there's all this data, and all we're doing is moving the data around. We can't be responsible for what's actually in the information. We have no reporters, but we're going to go ahead and take that information and turn it into a Facebook news feed that looks like news, and then you wonder why something went wrong with that theory. These are things that we're going to have to address. I'm not going to cover those adequately today. I'm just going to point them out and let you find somebody at a future speaker, because I actually do not have a Facebook page. I do not Twitter. I work with email. I tend to write 300 to 500 words. If I'm going to write something, 140 characters is not going to do it. But this is not entirely new. This is a quote from Isaac Asimov, a science writer and a science fiction writer. 1980, he'd been at it for 20 years at that point. There's a cult of ignorance in the United States that has always been. The strain of anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge. I think that pretty well describes what's happened with social media in the United States these days, and he was predicting that 40 years in advance. I was worried about scientists losing credibility. I noticed that change. And so I had been working with MIT in 2015, trying to encourage the campus ministry there to hold a large conference to kind of discuss this. And we were getting partway along with that. And then came Black Lives Matter, where it was all about outrage, unconstrained by facts, was a political power. And that prompted Trump. And the whole thing sort of blew up, as I describe it. My idea was we were going to come together and discuss this. Imagine a nice little Japanese garden with a bridge over the koi pond, and science and religion would get together there and discuss things. And I didn't know a koi pond could make a 30-foot tsunami, but that's what it felt like. And I just went, we can no longer hold this conference in any reasonable fashion. It's become politicized. I'm going to need to come up with a new strategy. But that's where some of this stuff had come from. Winston Churchill. The best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter. And this, I don't know if it's bright enough to read. And I may need to.
Is there some medium ground where we can see him? It's either all or nothing.
So in your report, memoir, whatever, you claim to have thwarted an invasion by space monkeys. Yep. Oh, let's do a little fact-checking. First, there's no evidence that space monkeys exist. Well, duh, that's because I stopped their invasion. Since you don't see them around, it's proof that my story is factual. My brain just jackknifed on your highway of logic. The fast lane of genius isn't for the meek, so keep up or get out. This is what passes for critical thinking and rhetoric and debate these days, is some very strange stuff. And if I can find a solution for a lot of what's going on, I think it is in some educating our citizens and how to do rhetoric, how to do logic, how to debate without tearing the other person down, and in some fashion, thinking about things clearly and clear thought. That has been really the stuff I want to talk about today, is what is it that I am after rather than showing all the stuff that I'm not. This is a quote I love: cherish those who seek the truth, but beware of those who find it. I worry about people who know the truth with a capital T. It's been attributed to multiple people. More importantly, it isn't what you don't know, it's what you know that ain't so that really gets you into trouble. This has been attributed to Mark Twain and a few other people, and it's hard to come up with a good provenance on it. And finally, it comes down to somebody called René Descartes, the cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Descartes had come to the conclusion that all of that he'd been taught was so polluted with wrong things that he thought, I'm just going to have to start over from scratch. What is it that I know for certain, so I can then derive everything from that? And what he ultimately came up with was the idea, I think, therefore I am. And I know that for a certainty, and went on from there. He also wrote what would be sort of the start of modern science, the discourse on rightly conducting one's reason, as I said, that ability to do critical thinking, and seeking truth in the sciences. And this is 1637. So we've gone through Greek and Roman knowledge through the Middle Ages. We're past the Renaissance into Enlightenment thinking at this point, and a recognition, yeah, but everything we know is so contaminated with wrong stuff that we don't know what we really can rely on. So let's start all over again, he says. My last little quote here is something I just heard recently and I'm still having fun thinking about. I'm at an age where I don't care about intellectual supremacy. I want to know the truth. This is a play, and the speaker is a professor nearing her retirement, debating with a grad student and saying, yeah, at this point, it isn't about all the politics of academia. She's old enough now and has reached the point in her profession where it doesn't matter anymore, but I'm still interested in what is truly the truth. And so I'll get to a quick practical background. I've been pretty theoretical at this point for a while. I'm going to bounce back to some practice. Sources of medical information, because that's where I deal with it most. If you go back to the 1880s, we were mostly doing snake oil and tonics, and it's really a caveat emptor situation. You believed whatever you wanted from whatever people were advertising, and the accuracy was not always there. So the government in 1906 recognized that, yes, this is a problem, and so we are going to create the ethical drug industry, and we're going to have government regulation that will define what is true and what is not, and separate the wheat from the chaff. This was followed by some professional associations, by medical education looking at the situation and coming to the same conclusion. There are so many different medical schools out there doing things in so many different ways. We don't know what is right and what is wrong. Let's start over, and here is a way of doing the education and a set of concepts that need to be taught. And it looks like Descartes all over again. We're just going to throw out everything we've known so far and start from scratch. This was followed by journals, and medical science progressed significantly through the 20th century. And by 1984, we started getting infomercials telling us, here are all these little drugs and nutritional supplements that will help you out. And this got supported in 1994 by a congressional bill introduced by Orrin Hatch. Thank you, Senator. The Dietary Supplement Health Education Act. And basically what it said was, medical science doesn't have it all right, so we need a direct-to-consumer, consumer-sharing information with each other ability. And all they have to do is say the FDA has not approved this information. And in some very fine print, it says, this product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Now, I'm pretty sure the other 29 minutes of the commercial were telling me exactly what this supplement was going to do for me. And now we get this fine print disclaimer that you can't even really read if you've got an old TV. And we move on. It sounds like we've now come full circle back to advertisements, snake oil, and caveat emptor entirely. George Santayana said, if those who do not remember history, the past, are condemned to repeat it. And that's what we're doing in medicine. Medicine has several corners for validated knowledge, for what it calls truth. Several cornerstones, several ways of thinking about it. And I'm going to show you some parallels between this and religion. There's the faith-based concept. The practitioners have witnessed that they've done this and this good thing has happened. They've done it and this has happened. And they can tell anecdote after anecdote. So I am sitting listening to a Christian Science practitioner describe this in the Mother Church in Boston. And I'm thinking, but that's all confirmation bias. Every scientist, skeptical scientist, would know you're looking for something to happen, you see it when it happens, and you're convincing yourself, therefore, this is true. And that's not science, that's religion. There's expert-based. You get somebody in court testifying to what is and is not true. Regulation-based knowledge, what the government says is true or not based on its regulations. There's a science-based, which is certainly my background, quantitative physiology, which says I need experimental data and I need to observe the same thing happening over and over again so I can predict with very high probability that it's going to happen again. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That's Einstein's approach to truth. That's the science-based. We've moved a little beyond that in medicine in some ways. We've gone to experience-based, what in medicine's called the morbidity and mortality conference. When something bad happens, the surgeons get together, they talk about it, they find somebody to blame, they figure out what went wrong, they find something that's going to keep that from happening again. They never check to see if that truly works. They never check to see whether that causes more trouble than benefit. And 10 years later, nobody can remember why we have to do this extra test. It's just been the way it's always been done. It has advanced science of medicine a lot. It has certainly improved surgery through the 20th century, but it is just not a good method for the 21st century. Then we have evidence-based medicine, which involves a lot of meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. That was started mostly in the 1970s, and the term evidence-based medicine was coined in 1992. We're at the 25-year anniversary of that. And my sabbatical for the last couple years has been looking at this and asking, has it worked? Has it done what Descartes wanted to do? Has it looked at all of the stuff that we were getting wrong and purified it through the use of evidence and randomized controlled trials? And my conclusion is absolutely not. And we've got the most cited article in PLOS by John Ioannidis, who's now a Stanford professor, has suggested that half of medical research that is published is wrong. And that is the most cited article of that entire journal. The editor of the British Medical Journal had looked at what was going on in about 1994. And he had an editorial written by somebody who is now the really most reputable statistician, most famous statistician at Oxford. And again, coming to the conclusion that we're publishing an awful lot of stuff that is wrong and asking why is that the case. We're making great progress along the way anyhow, at great expense, but something seems to be wrong more than just, hey, we're finding something new. And that's some of what I've been working on. But now let me take you back through this, the faith-based, the expert and regulation-based, which I'm going to call tradition, the science-based, which I'm going to call reason, and the experience and evidence-based, which is experience. Scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. If that is familiar to you as what's known as the Wesleyan quadrilateral. That's Methodist background. I don't even know what the Lutherans have that matches that exactly, but it's the idea these are the four pillars upon which mankind has revelation, humankind has come to understand truth.
Don't we do sola scriptura and sola fide?
Pretty much, you hear those. And the Episcopalians just have scripture, tradition, and reason. They don't add the experience that the Methodists do. So churches have tried this, and religion, rather than religion and science, I prefer faith and reason as the two things that I try and talk about. People of faith have tried various ways to find out what is true and what is not. And they've come up with different methods to try and vet whether something is true. And they've come roughly to the same conclusions many, many centuries before. Scientists came up with the same thing, and modern medicine has come up with sort of that same list. And it's a question of how do we decide among these different ways what is true and what is not. My point being that Trump did not invent post-truth, the medical research did. We've been at this a long time. I want this to somewhat be a discussion. I got a few more minutes on one thing to do, but let me break for a moment and ask if there are any questions about what I've covered so far or comments.
All right.
Actually, I'll ask one.
Yeah.
So I've worked in research labs, and it seems 25 years ago, you know, there were this many journals that my supervisor was reading and considered important, and now it's like there are this many journals, and how do you even decide what, you know, the editors and what they accept, and it, that seems like this crazy.
It's an amazing progress. Immunology, when I took the course, and I delayed taking it for 2 years because I knew it was an advancing science when I was in medical school, and I was getting my PhD at the same time, so I spread out the MD courses over years. And the first textbook was about that thick, and it was essentially a list of experiments because nobody could put the whole thing together. It was, here's what we knew. And within 3 years, you had the yearly output of a journal of immunology was that thick, and a couple years later, it was filling shelves of libraries. We are publishing a tremendous amount, and there's a big push for publishing. And Doug Altman, who is the Oxford statistician who wrote the editorial for BMJ, his feeling is that that's a big piece of the problem, is this need to publish. People are not looking for truth. They're looking for some little thing that they can get a p-value of 0.05, which is good enough that somebody will publish it. I wish I could tell you that this was all about a bunch of bad journals out there, and we're not even talking about the fake journals, and you know that's a huge source of problems right now. But yesterday I spent 2 hours on an article from the New England Journal of Medicine where I had, on Friday I had written the editor and saying, yeah, this looks like we ought to put that on the front page of our next issue of a journal newspaper that I am on the advisory board for, but can you actually send me the full copy of it, not the abstract that I have, because the full copy had been embargoed up until it was published. I can get it from her if I know, as long as I don't reveal it to anything. So she sent me that, and it was delayed 18 hours and a little new problem with her email system. And by the time I got that on Saturday afternoon and we spent 3 hours on it, I went, this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, I do not think proves what it claims to prove. I have 3 people already on my listserv who have looked at it and come to the same conclusion. Not even on the front page. I don't even want it in the journal next, in our next publication. And we're going to have to write a letter to the editor and complain about it. It exists within the very best journals out there. And it is a push to publish. And this experiment was a huge study, very, very well done in many ways, but it was entirely done to prove its point, not to be skeptical about its point. And the result is the bias is of an ascertainment bias is so great, there's no way you can believe the data, no way you should believe the data. So science has certainly progressing, but it's creating itself some problems with credibility, because it is publishing a lot of stuff which isn't right, because some scientists have allowed themselves to become mercenaries, such as the tobacco industry, such as Exxon with the climate change issues. So I'm dealing with things like climate change deniers and vaccine hesitancy, where people are worried about vaccines. It was curious to me, very much of a surprise, that California actually in 2015 passed as legislation the toughest law against refusing vaccines in the nation at this point. Maybe it's on the same level as Mississippi's. And thinking, boy, that's a very blue state. Why in the world would it have done that? And going, yeah, but what prompted it was 100 cases of measles at Disneyland. And yeah, that's a whole lot of money involved, and this is not going to be acceptable. So that apparently is what it takes in California to convince of a blue state to become very conservative on philosophical objections to vaccines. It basically said if you've got a medical reason for it, you need a doctor to document that. The doctor actually has to write it down. And obviously that implies that if the doctor is doing things that he shouldn't be doing, the license is at risk, and that will probably stop a lot of the false stuff that's going on for objecting to vaccines. That is somewhat the progress of medicine that I've been working on. Why I'm saying that scientists have lost some credibility. We've done some bad things recently. A small number have, and it has created within the public this sense that they're not quite as sure that they can believe scientists anymore. And that's really the point of the epistemology and of how much can you believe something? What is truth and how certain are we of truth? And epistemology has three different phases to it. And I like teaching these differences with a bit of an analogy. Baseball. Balls and strikes. The pitcher throws the ball, it crosses the plate. Was it a ball or strike? Now, classically, you'd say, well, did it go through the box? That's the edges of the plate and the batter's knees and the batter's shoulders, and there you go. But we don't really have somebody that can tell you that perfectly. There's not a physical way of sorting it out for sure. What we have in the real game is an umpire. And the umpire says, I calls them as I sees them. And that is the modern idea of truth, that yeah, the human being is involved in this and there is some uncertainty and we need to understand that as we work with truth. The third phase, which is more of a postmodern approach, is the umpire saying, they're not balls and strikes until I says they're balls and strikes. It's all a human construct, it's all what I call it as, and that defines the reality. I am the judge of this game, and that's how it's going to be. I'm going to suggest we have now moved one step further to a transhuman version of it, where we have a machine that can tell us whether or not it crossed the plate or not, whether or not that tennis ball hit the line or not, whether after a touchdown is scored in football, everybody stares up at the replay screen, waiting to see if it's going to be confirmed or not. And until the replay says it is or is not, it's not a touchdown. Those are ideas of truth. That is a transhuman approach. We've gotten there. And until a computer says that it's right, it seems a lot of people can't accept it as the truth. I, as a pediatrician, in the delivery room would often examine the baby, and I thought I was providing some reassurance to the family of, yes, I'm here and I've seen your baby and the baby looks healthy. Nowadays, you have at least four machines have to tell you that your baby is healthy before you can leave the hospital. What I do doesn't matter anymore, it seems. It's a transhuman approach and it's changing things. And so this idea of truth, they are balls and strikes. I calls them as I sees them. They aren't balls and strikes until I say they are. And it's not a ball or a strike until it's been checked by instant replay are different ways of looking at truth. And it is altering our understanding of how we approach things. I'm going to suggest a fifth version that goes beyond this. And that's what I call the tapestry version. And this gets into some other things, but really looks at the idea of you have to look at the overall picture, and I'll get into that a little later today. Here are just a couple examples of what I've been saying. This is a reporter thinking in the modern era, dealing with Trump and the most recent administration. You just cannot screw up in this environment because they'll use every small mistake to come after you and suggest that you had some nefarious motive in your reporting. And so if there's one small mistake, all of media is condemned as unreliable and possibly even nefariously working conspiracy theories trying to harm things. And then the NFL vice president of officiating. The problem is that it's an impossible job to do in real time. They really do a great job, but here's what technology has done, and here's what instant replay has done. I think it's taken the level of expectation to perfection, and it's not possible. It's not possible. Even one mistake is not acceptable. You can have guys in a crew work a game with 163 plays, and they officiate 162 of them perfectly, but they miss one, and it becomes the story. And social media takes one mistake and blows it out over everything, and you can't get away with it. Now, that's a pretty strong indication of where we have come in dealing with truth. If we've gotten to this point where even one tiny mistake means that everything you've done has to be thrown out and it's wrong. So this is the way I want to approach it. Trying to deal with some of this polarization, this gotcha approach. And that is to say, truth is a tapestry. So if I talk about the theory of evolution and why I believe things have occurred over 14 billion years the universe, and look at that very deep time and look at what has happened, the theory is not perfect, but the picture is unmistakable. Is this picture a question to anybody here? It's a little dumb. It's, no, that's the Last Supper. It's a tapestry of the Last Supper. Now, if I want to argue about whether that particular thing should be yellow or yellow-green, as a scientist, we can spend lots of time working on that. Those are the details. But if it's proven that I thought it was yellow and then finally it's proven yellow-green, it does not change the truth of the entire rest of the tapestry. And so when intelligent design tries to come up with a set of issues with the current theory, and it ends up taking multiple different scientists to debunk their complaints, even if they got one thing right, it wouldn't change the tapestry. That approach to truth is going to get us farther in the future than continuing to work like scientists, where if one data point says the theory doesn't work, the theory is worthless. That might have been true when we were dealing with some very simple physical laws. The laws, Maxwell's equations. These are the laws of electromagnetic phenomena, four equations that describe it. Light is an electromagnetic phenomenon. If you could find one clearly true data point that said this curve that this describes doesn't fit that, it would overthrow the entire theory. That's not going to happen with basic laws of physics and laws of thermodynamics. But when you get into something as messy as medicine, there are going to be times where we find something new that changes things. And as I suggested earlier, half of what I was taught has since been proven wrong. Some of that because we've got new theory. Some of it because the stuff we originally had was clearly based on bad science, science that should have been rejected, should have never been published in the first place. This is my idea of replacing a transhuman, highly polarized idea of truth with a more human way of look at the overall tapestry and kind of ask yourself, does that work? And when I look at Christianity, that's what I'm doing. Thank you.
What I keep thinking as you're describing changing ideas in medicine, for instance, mm-hmm. is in addition, one thing that changes ideas of what is the truth is scientists have better and better equipment. And so they can know things, understand things that were not available to them before. And that changes what is the current thinking of the truth, the strongest theory.
It has. And so from that, if I am trying to do, working with people, doing pastoral counseling in the hospital, it's your images of illness and death and why they occur come from the Bible, which is hundreds of years old, well out of date, and being used in ways it shouldn't. And so, as you said, at some point, our whole imagery doesn't make sense anymore. And if that's the case, you're going to have a problem because it isn't going to match the reality of the person you're working with. We have advanced. We need our imagery within Christianity to move forward as well. So people have been working at trying to do that. And asking, how can science and religion relate? And even the science and religion implies a separateness and some sort of interface. Maybe it's science in religion or religion in science. Can we come up with different ways? Stephen Gould was one philosopher working on this, had the non-overlapping magisteria. Well, there's what science describes and what religion describes, and they don't overlap. They're different things entirely. Good ideas and bad ideas in that. Richard Dawkins is an evangelical atheist. It's not just enough to be an atheist these days. He wants to go out and convert people to atheism. John Paul, Pope John Paul said, faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth. That both science, both faith and reason, this is Fides et Ratio, faith and reason. It's one of his encyclicals. And he's trying to describe the wings are connected, but they're two different wings, both lifting us up, and if it was only one wing, it wouldn't work. From Lutheran theology, Ted Peters has 8 different ways of looking at it. I am not going to try and even come close to covering those today. Another Lutheran theologian said, today's churches have no other place to fulfill their mission than a world whose basic assumptions are pervaded more and more by science. We're in a world of science. It is changing what we understand, how we view things, newer in technologies. The anecdote that Valerie described earlier is one I had gotten from Grace Wolf Chase. She is an astronomer and an educator at Adler Planetarium in Chicago. She describes at a national convention of astronomers, when the Hubble Space Telescope was aimed at a black area of space and left aiming at that for several days so it could collect light from stuff that was as far away as we'd ever seen, it produced a photograph just covered in speckles. And this was blown up to about a 6 by 4 foot spot and put on a wall. She describes watching astronomers walk by, stare at it, and just this sense of awe coming over their faces. Because they knew what that meant. They knew that every speckle on there is not a star. Each has to be a galaxy to be seen at this distance. And just realizing how small they were in the world, that it is a universal human truth. It's somehow hardwired into our neurology, this sense of awe that we are some little speck in something this big. And I think the same thing happens with time, because to astronomers, they also know what that means, is that stuff is coming, what I'm seeing here, left the star, left the galaxy, and arrived here 14.69 billion years later. And there we are, 14 billion is 13.7, let me get it accurate. Billion years with the world. You know, one little mistake like that and the entire talk is worthless, right? This is Pope Francis, however, looking at it and saying, how wonderful would it be if the growth of science and technological innovation would come along with more equality and social inclusion? How wonderful would it be, while we discover faraway planets, to rediscover the needs of the brothers and sisters orbiting around us? Some sense of the awe, some sense of what love means. These are people trying to grasp and describe what our relationship is with each other, what our faith and values and religion are wrapped around what is the reality of the world. So my point in all this is I look at all that awe and wonder, but ultimately I demand science, as opposed to religion, to be very skeptical. And so while I am certainly moved by awesome things, as were these astronomers, ultimately you're going to get me back into my numbers and my calculations. And contrary to the way things are being portrayed in modern media, The true scientist is not trying to prove that their theory is right. In true science, done by the appropriate method, the scientist does everything possible to disprove their theory and only publishes it when they say, I have exhausted everything I can come up with and there is no other explanation for these observations than this new correlation, this new theory. Too much of modern medical research works in the other way. If I can massage the data until I get a p-value of 0.05, I can publish it whether it's true or not. And the result is we get a lot of massage data, and if you look at it enough different ways, one time out of 20, you're going to get a correlation which is entirely spurious. And that's what the p-value of 0.05 means. But it isn't a declaration of, well, this is such a surprising piece of data then that you have to believe my theory. You've gone the other way around, and the result is you're doing very bad science. This brings me one step farther then. What happens if your scientific research suggests what the Bible says is wrong? What would you do? So, three instances in my life where I've had that issue with thinking about that. One was at a first job interview after finishing residency at a college of osteopathy. And after the interview, I was just kind of wandering around a little bit, you know, some deep, dark dungeon of a hallway well below anything that most people would be in. There was a display case with a little poster in it that said, paraphrasing it, if you do research and find facts that contradict first principles, these were the first principles of their osteopathy, the first principles are right and the research is wrong. Now, I've just spent the last 12 years getting the most expensive, extensive education you can imagine in science and medicine and doing some ethics, and I am standing in front of that and going, there's a problem with this. I actually went back there several years later and I tried to find that and it had disappeared, and I tried to actually, because I would have loved a picture of it. When I was there, it was long before everybody had cell phones, you could write it. But it just struck me, no, as a scientist, I cannot accept that first principles. Second instance, what I already described, was the Christian Science practitioner describing how they see things happen and it confirms what they believed in the first place. And the third, last week, very much the same thing, a Muslim at a, was the main speaker at a conference in science and religion, going over some of the history of Muslim science, but then at one point saying, and he as a scientist, you know, will follow this data unless it contradicts something in the Quran. And I hear that phrase again and go, no. I as a scientist will follow where this goes as far as I need to. And some of that is my point of that if I find a scientific thing and it contradicts what I believe the Bible is saying, my understanding of the Bible is probably wrong, and I need to reconsider that. I'm not saying all of Christian faith is disproven. I'm saying I think that there is probably a misunderstanding. Now, if you saw my grades in my science classes, my engineering classes, and my theology classes, you would say that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. That you probably do have the wrong theology. But I'm going to argue even the very good theologians should ask that question of, if science ultimately shows them something with enough convincing to say that their interpretation of some verse in the Bible has to be reconsidered, the true scientist will cross that line and say, I need to redo this. And in a world that is so pervaded by science these days, I think that the church, Lutheran and Christian and beyond that, needs to give strong credence to that idea of doing things. That is the push that really I am working on most recently, is what happens when what I'm seeing disagrees with some key principle. I discovered that the Earth revolves around the Sun. How can you prove it? By using the scientific method. With enough equations, I'll confuse you into accepting that I'm right. And that's what this little t-shirt does for you. But I'm going to suggest that my point here on challenging our understanding of the Bible, letting science challenge us, don't take my word for it. I'm going to take you back to St. Augustine, 4th and 5th century church father for the Catholic Church. And this is his work on the literal meaning of Genesis. Usually, even a non-Christian knows something about the earth, the heavens, and the other elements of the world, about the motion and orbit of the stars, and even their size and relative positions, about predictable eclipses, blah, 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 about animals, shrubs. And this knowledge he holds to being certain from reason and experience. Now, it is a disgraceful and dangerous thing for an infidel to hear a Christian, presumably giving the meaning of Holy Scripture, talking nonsense on these topics. And we should take all means to prevent such an embarrassing situation in which people show up vast ignorance in a Christian and laugh it to scorn. The shame is not so much that an ignorant individual is derided, but that people outside the household of faith think our sacred writers held such opinions, and to the great loss of those whose salvation we toil, the writers of our scripture are criticized and rejected as unlearned men. And so when each fall the new freshmen come to MIT and drop by the ministry there, we have to deal with this idea of, can you be a scientist and still be a Christian? And each year the graduate students kind of allowed that to go on for a month or two or three, and then got back to doing the topics we really like to do, because we were there for many more years than the undergraduates. But this has been a recurring theme in campus ministry, certainly going back to the Reagan years. It is improving, I think, over the last decade. Well, I'm hearing less and less concern with it, but it still happens. And I know that at the University of Illinois in Urbana, they're going to have in 3 weeks a talk on this subject. And I want to go up and see that speaker and see how that ministry is dealing with it. But my belief as a scientist, when I do my faith in science, is they are not incompatible. They work at different ways trying to get to truth. Sometimes I use the idea that science is soccer. I can only use my feet. I'm restricted, whereas faith can use hands and feet as it tries to play a sport. And soccer players would not be as good with their feet as they are if they were allowed to use their hands. So science is simply saying, it's empirical data. I need to use critical thinking, get data, prove that something is right using scientific method. That doesn't mean that there aren't other ways of thinking about it, or that there are other truths that the science cannot even approach. But that is what science does. Religion is answering other questions, but the two need to be interacting with each other, and one cannot be allowed to dominate and disprove the other purely on a principle. It needs to be based on some form of reality, and that has been doctrine of the Catholic Church for a long, long time. The real issues with creationism in the United States, particularly in the 1980s, 1990s, are all a very new phenomenon within American churches, almost entirely in the 20th century. And I think we understand that history, we won't quite repeat the same issues.
What explains that? Do you have a short paragraph on why this?
Why did that happen?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So recently. From
the history of it, I think a piece of it is that desire for certainty. People are looking for certainty, and if the world was 24-hour days for its creation 6,000 years ago, it seemed nice, clean, went together. I certainly remember going to events where that was preached at my university and various events, and just going, this is not for me, and looking for something more. And I think of the various Protestant churches, Lutherans have always had the most open mind towards it, towards science, and it's part of what has brought me to that. The Reformation ideas of all practice, it's not just knowledge that gets corrupted, all of our praxis gets corrupted too. As humans, we need to look back at it, think about it, and go, no, we need to do this different. We need to get rid of the indulgences. That is an approach that goes along with science.
So, I guess I just want to know if this is consistent with what you're saying. I think one of the most enlightening things that I ever read was the Tao of Physics, that made me understand that my conception of time was Western, and that I limited my ability to sort of scientifically see the biblical story because I viewed a day as 24 hours, whereas a day might be a billion years. And that sort of idea that I'm locked into certain definitions is, I think, part of what causes a lot of that conflict between science and theology, or science and belief.
And I think part of the modern and postmodern epistemology, rather than classical, has been recognition that somewhat we see what we see based on what we expect to see and what we have seen similar to it in the past. And so it's hardwired even into our brains. We've got lots of neurophysiology there to prove it these days, that we interpret what happens. It's not that we see it entirely objectively, we're interpreting it. And this is why a good detective knows if you ask five witnesses of a crime, you think you found at least four or five different crime scenes, because nobody saw the same thing happen. We are, as humans, programmed based on previous experiences. It hardwires our brain to then see things differently. And that is why, yes, Eastern thought, as it comes in, challenges some of the Western thought. And if you go back even and get the word a day of creation in the Hebrew, yom, there's suggestions to say that that is not perceived of as a 24-hour day in the history of the Hebrew language either. That's well out of my expertise. I can only cite having heard that. Other responses?
Reframe the problem that this passage is really lifting up. Could you reframe that in maybe a sentence or two? Augustine, the critical point.
Augustine's point was in people interpreting Genesis too literally, and even in his era, it would have been an issue of, you know, did the flood really exist? Does the earth go around the sun, or the now this, in that era, we are into Copernican arguments about Copernican theories that won't be decided for 1,000 years until Galileo comes along and does some more stuff with it. His point was that you can believe your experience if you have seen this happen, and then somebody tries to tell you the scripture says differently. It's okay to believe your experience. Beyond even that, it's not just okay. But the Christian who attempts to then persuade other people is making a mistake. And that will cause them to be laughed to scorn and will cause shame upon all other Christian writings, because people will consider Christians fools.
Thank you. Do you have any ideas on what to do to I think the anti-intellectual strain in American de Tocqueville wrote about it when he just first came, and that there's a...
Just 200 years ago.
Yeah. There's a sort of an American grain of distrusting scientific authority.
There has been a grain of that, certainly, but I think then you look at the space age in the 1960s and 1970s, where I would say scientists were at their peak, where people really, the rocket scientist and the amazing things that we have been able to build, accomplish, the certainty of those things, of explanations of phenomena, it all was making sense. There's always been a bit of a distrust of those intellectual elites from the Ivy League. If you come from my area of Nebraska, it's always been there. But it's had some emphasis recently, and some of that I think is because scientists have allowed some scientists to do some bad advocacy, like the tobacco industry. I think some of it is we're now working on things where the certainty with which we find new scientific discoveries are not as certain as they were when Maxwell was working on these equations. Some of it is a postmodern approach of distrusting human observations entirely. Those all feed into it, and every profession, if you look at it over a period of a couple centuries, has times where it's up and down. Scientists clearly have peaked and have dropped, and I have a concern about that, and more about the motives of the people who are jumping on that in the last few years.
How do you see that going?
It's going to go up and down, but the more times it's down, the more trouble it's going to be. I don't know how we're going to overcome it. My best idea on how to overcome it still seems to come down to, this is what I've worked with on the committees with the ELCA, it's you need the scientists to come into the pews and talk with people. And it's no different than, it's one thing to talk about homosexuals and another to talk about them if they're actually sitting in the pews with you. And if the scientists will stop leaving their science at the door, and I know many scientists who just leave everything at the door when they come to the church, go along with the party line there. When they go to work, same thing. Leave the Christianity at the door to the lab, particularly if you're in biology. If you can overcome that, I think you've got some progress that can be made, because it isn't us, them anymore.
I remember when The Last Temptation of Christ came out, and there was it was that movie that really portrayed Jesus' agonizing death, and just a whole long scene of suffering. And I went to a couple of lectures at St. Louis University, Bill and I went, and there were some scripture scholars, and it was the idea the Jews killed Jesus, mm-hmm. and this is what it looks like, and if he could suffer that much for you, that should pull forth your devotion. And some scripture scholars really made clear how Jesus died and who were the players. And one man stood up and he says, "You intellectuals just take away the meaning of that." There was this clear thing as I don't want to know any of the factual, historical probabilities, that somehow to search for fact takes away piety, devotion, everything I've ever believed, and that if we reconstructed the Jews didn't kill Jesus, in that sort of way that we've led to quite a bit of difficulty in our theology, that somehow the whole thing disappears, our devotion, our sense that Jesus died for me, that the two things got messed with, and that the intellectuals should just shut up, because this was a lovely piece of film that stimulated my devotion, mm-hmm. and you have changed it. As soon as you tell me, this was not the Jewish people, or whatever the objection was. But
something that is almost the idea that faith is, I'm told this in church, and I believe it, and it would be wrong for me to allow any scientist to talk me out of it. And occasionally I see that in people looking for miracles when a child is dying. And, well, it's all about faith at this point, of believing the miracle will happen. And I'm a scientist that works in predictions, and what I'm predicting right now is, you know, I've got to be careful how I'm phrasing it, but it's basically, no, that nothing we do at this point is going to matter. Our idea of the faith as being something against intellectualism, that we have to believe something in spite of our observations, is a corrupted theology that has stuck in over the years. And that's why I like this, where Augustine says, no, you can't let that happen.
That's why I had trouble with your earlier slides when you said faith is about religion and reason is about science.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like such an artificial dichotomy, a stereotype.
It does. And that why Ted Peters has come up with 8 different ways of trying to describe how these things interact, to try and avoid that and to give it some depth. I think we're running out of time here. I'm going to have to close up. I'm glad to talk afterwards, though. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it.